Around the world, women do much of the work that keeps societies running. But far too often, that labor is either unseen or undervalued. Whether it's unpaid care work, precarious jobs in the informal economy, or new roles shaped by digital platforms, the systems that benefit from women's work rarely center their voices or their realities. In Ghana and across Africa, these dynamics are deeply intertwined with colonial histories, global capitalism, and a rigid gender division of labor. And while international frameworks like the Sustainable Development Goals claim to promote equality, they often fail to address the deeper structures holding these inequalities in place. So how can we rethink sustainable development from the perspective of women's lived realities, especially in the global south? And what would a truly gender-just and decolonial approach to labor look like? That's what we'll explore in today's episode of Meridian, the podcast of the Berlin Center for Global Engagement. I'm Kevin Kainers. Welcome. Joining me is Professor Angela Okorzu, a leading scholar of labor and gender studies and the current dean of the School for Development Studies at the University of Cape Coast, Ghana. As the Audre Lorde Visiting Professor for Intersectional Diversity Studies with the Berlin University Alliance, she's exploring how digital platforms, power structures, and inequalities shape women's work, and what kinds of transformation are truly needed to improve the situation. Professor Okorzu, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
To begin, I'd be curious to just hear a little bit about your own journey. Were there key moments within your academic life that have shaped your understanding of gender and labor?
Yeah, I'd say that's been very grateful to have a postgraduate studies in the internationally accredited Institute for Social Studies in the Netherlands, and that started my journey. This international institution brought together students from the global south and provided me with both global perspective and as well as a theoretical base that served as the foundation for my sustained interest in workers. And this is how it all started. And at that, during my postgraduate studies in the Netherlands, my notion of what constitutes workers was very much challenged. And I was introduced to informality as a very growing phenomenon. In spite of that, when I graduated, the first few publications of mine were still very much focused on the formal sector until about 5 years later.
Okay. So you mean focused on workers who receive a salary as opposed to more informal workers in Ghana or?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yes. But then I felt my publications were disconnected from the growing body of knowledge in the field at the time. Why? Because the currency was the changing nature of work after post-structural adjustment implementation in Africa. And so I decided to join that discourse and contributed what I would describe as collection of nuanced contribution on different types of work, including domestic workers.
Mm-hmm. You've been in the academic system for a long time. Are there any lessons that you've drawn from your time there and how the genders can be made more equal or how there can be more equality within the genders?
Yes. In academia, I would say that the space is very, very patriarchal. It is still very much male-dominated, even in our space. My visit here to Berlin is also showing similar patterns. So it is a problem of the academy and not just a global location. And that has a colonial history. Knowledge production has been epistemologically male-centered. And so we can understand that that's where it's coming from. My interest in gender was also helped by mentoring, for instance. And I've had opportunity to serve as the research coordinator of the Gender Center at the University of Cape Coast. In that leadership position in a male-dominated university, I learned that it is very important for a female scholar to succeed. It is very important to stick to principles, especially in taking decisions. In that case, you'll be protected. You could defend the decisions you took without getting into trouble.
Okay. Do you have an example of that maybe that you could share? Or what do principles mean?
like sticking to the rules, not taking decisions based on your personal interest or to satisfy a particular friend or anybody you know in the system. But sticking to the statutes that guide the operations of the university is very, very important. That is what I mean in taking decisions, yeah.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, you are based at usually the university in Ghana, and you're also from Ghana. Can you tell us a bit about the situation there in terms of how the gender division of labor shapes women's lives?
Yeah. The work of Ghanaians is very much shaped by gender division of labor. And this is even with pre-colonial societies in Ghana. Women and men in the past worked together on the same farms, but then they did different activities on the farm. That means work was already categorized according to male-female stereotypes or characteristics. But then colonial contact then came in to structure work differently. They set up plantations and mines and administrative offices and took the men away and gave them a wage employment. So they introduced wage employment, leaving the women behind to take care of subsistence agriculture and then take care of household chores also, which were not paid. And so that is where the categorization of paid and unpaid work started. It started with colonial contact. So to a large extent, yes, gender division of labor is very much structured, influential in the work we do. So we find that when we come to Ghana, there are more women in domestic activities who do not earn any income. Per our statistics, only 32% of the workforce in Ghana are in paid employment. What it means is that
2%?
32.
Oh, 32. Still not very much.
Yes, not very much. And when you go to the informal economy, it is the women who dominate. And the informal economy, you know, is the sector of the economy, which is very much unregulated, unprotected, and outside the purview of the labor regulations.
And so are there structures of power that are responsible for the creation of this gender divide, or that it still exists today?
Yeah, I'd re-emphasize that it started with colonial legacy, and that's set up the really rigid and blatant introduction of patriarchal structures. And this is where value was placed on men's work at the expense
of... Because they got a wage.
Yes, yes. And women's work was then devalued or not valued at all, unpaid for. And so the hierarchical introduction of gender division of labor is what we are talking about. Not that there were no gender division even before colonial contact. And I must say that after that, a capitalist system has also reinforced these existing structures. It borrowed from the colonial legacy and has reinforced it in so many ways. And so if you interrogate theories like social reproduction theory, it is saying that because women are not being paid for the work they do, especially in caring for the current generation of workforce, as well as the future generation of workforce, capitalists are able to make excessive profits. And so they benefit from women's unpaid work and appropriate the excess profits in that process. Otherwise, they would have to invest in the care of their future generation, which are the children that the women do care for, as well as the present generation, which will be husbands, as it were. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And even the past generation, which will be retirees, which are also under the care of women, most women in invisible household spaces.
I guess it's less a part of the formal economy in Ghana than in a place like Germany.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, that's very true.
One thing that you've worked on or looked into during your fellowship, how the digital platform economy is transforming work. Can you tell us a bit about your work on that or your thinking on that and the sort of risks and opportunities that are coming with these digital platforms and the way they're transforming work?
Yeah. In the past, you could identify a person's work with the location. But now the location is usually on the space cloud. right? So the introduction of technology, for instance, has made it possible for a lot of platforms to recruit people anywhere around the world. And because it is happening in the space, that space, they are outside the regulation of national labor laws. So then we are having an international body of workforce that nobody is really monitoring and protecting. And that is quite very dangerous. And in this space, we are also finding a lot of women. Women because it offers flexible work forms for them. It offers opportunities that otherwise in the traditional work structure, they wouldn't access. And so we find that a lot of women are also in these spaces. But then they also still suffer the precarity that comes with the work that is very much unregulated. And the most devastating thing about platform work is the interrogation of the identity of the worker as a worker. But then insisting that these workers are contractors or people who have chose to use the platform for earning income rather than being employees. And so absorbing the platform owners of all the responsibility they can have towards protecting the dignity and decency of the people they use.
And so what sort of platforms are we talking about? Like things like Uber?
Yes. Well, my work has just so far centered on Uber. And so we've done ride-hailing drivers in Ghana. And we see that it comes with a lot of uncertainty. Uncertainty because at the slightest offense, then you are cut off from using the platform. There are also high commission from the platform owners. And so because of that, the drivers are not able to earn as much as they would like to. What this means is that they have to work excessively long hours. On the average, we found that about 17 hours on the road driving. And they've had to take drugs, energy drinks to sustain themselves. And we found in our research, drivers have toothbrushes and basic things in their cars because they are always on the road, which also makes it very dangerous for other road users, to be honest. But then in Ghana, we see that these ride-hailing drivers displayed some measure of agency, right? So they decided to form an association, and after which then they applied to the Trade Union Congress in Ghana to protect them. Because again, they found that the state, which was supposed to protect them, was also issuing another level of taxation. So they attempted to tax them for having special licenses for using the Uber app and the Bolt app. But then they thought that that would be unfair. Their drivers, they already have driver's licenses. And so they sought help from the trade union, which we found really remarkable that they are resisting the exploitation that was going on. But so far, very little has been achieved. But we see cases of rights claimed around the world. There are good examples in Kenya and elsewhere. So we know that once they organize and seek a voice and representation from the trade unions, eventually we will see some change in the way the apps are dealing with them. We have also proposed as a recommendation that we should have localized apps. We have what it takes, ICT, technological guys. If you could have local apps or state-owned apps, then that could be a protection and could be protected. And so that's some of the issues around the platform work in particular. But I must say there are different kinds of problems with the different kinds of space internet-based work. And those who work with algorithms, for instance, are very much controlled surveillance. And then you are under surveillance all the time. It takes away your human dignity. And being managed by an algorithm is not the best. And so these are some of the things we want to interrogate in the future going forward.
Mm-hmm. Has it changed the nature of work for women very much in a place like Ghana?
I wouldn't say so. Even though it gives them opportunities to have some way. In the ride-hailing space, there are very few women because it's very dangerous. Some of the challenges they face is snatching of cars in the night when they have to drive. So, and it's not too safe. Even the men have experienced a lot of sexual harassment in the course of their work. So very few women are in that space unless they are really, really desperate. But in other types of internet-based work, yes, that women are in. We also find that there are double beddings because they have to still combine with their household chores. It's not like stepping out of the house to go and work right. And then you leave the dishes and go and come, or you leave childcare in another person's hands. But you have to combine everything. And that is very strenuous. And the effects on women's health, well-being, also generating an issue of what we call time poverty and the absence of leisure is not the best.
Mm. I mean, you alluded a little bit to what you'd like to see maybe change in that maybe the government themselves creates an app that's more focused on workers' rights. But are there any other policies that you would like to see implemented to protect workers in this new environment?
Yes, a lot can be done. I must say that in one work I have done, I interrogated the role of the state in all this. And I describe the state as capitalist state or pro-capitalist state. And so we have nation states now that do not protect its citizens, that are protecting capital's interest at the expense of their people's interest, unfortunately. And that is what it is. So the further this platform's owners get licenses from the state means that they can have some checks and control, but then they overlook some of these things. And it is worrying. We can blame it largely on the broader neoliberal dispensation that most of our African states have taken on to. There have been hints in our research, there have been hints about the presence of corruption of state officials who benefit from these international capital owners in ways that make them overlook what they should be doing. And so that makes it really unfortunate because to a large extent, it is the state's responsibility to regulate this through legislation, right? Our labor laws, unfortunately, is still very much focused on the formal sector. It is being revised currently, and hopefully with all these inputs, we hope that it will be able to expand to reach the protection of informal workers and platform workers and other forms of internet-based work. But in addition to that is the role of trade unions. I mean, even though trade unions are getting weaker around the world and also in Ghana, they continue to remain relevant and their influence cannot be overlooked. And so we want to, as much as possible, invest in strengthening our trade unions to protect the workers. Even what is left of the formal sector still needs protection. They need to expand their activities beyond formal sector work as we know it to cover all these emerging forms of work. We don't know what the future holds. Now we are talking of platform. AI is also emerging very strongly. And so the nature and the future of work is very much threatened and is changing. And so trade unions must also be very proactive in responding to these changes. Otherwise, the capitalist is always looking for ways to expand, maximize profit, no matter what it takes. As we find solutions to existing problems, they are coming up with new ones. And so we have to be on our feet. And catching up with them has been extremely difficult, to be honest, even for us researchers and for trade unions.
Yes. Another thing you've worked on is the idea of decolonizing knowledge. First, can you tell us what that means for those of us that don't know? And what would you say the key debates are within that effort?
Yeah. when we talk about decolonizing knowledge, then we are suggesting that there has been knowledge colonization. And so again, going back to the colonial history, so apart from the introduction, the division of value division of labor, we also have what we call epistemicide. One author calls it epistemicide, the epistemic genocide of African people, where they destroyed our knowledge base. So the colonial masters destroyed our knowledge base. How did they do that? They demonized our belief systems, our knowledge systems, and replaced our language forms with European languages. In Ghana, it's English. Other African countries, French. Then we have Portuguese. We are all the same people speaking different European languages. To a large extent, European languages became the epistemic language. And you know what language means for a people? It is the medium of thinking. It is the medium of knowledge creation. And so once your language is destroyed, much of your epistemic positioning is taken away. And in that sense, there was injustices, right? Our knowledge, ways of knowing were also treated as superstitious and not rational, and so on. And so there came to be what we know as Eurocentric knowledge epistemology and also Androcentric knowledge forms. So as the Africans were dispossessed of their epistemic existence, also women around the world, not only in Africa, were dispossessed of their knowledge as knowers. So there was a lot of harm done to marginalized people around the world in terms of knowing their experiences and communicating that and all that. And there are different types of epistemic injustices, but these are just an example, broadly speaking, when it comes to Africans as a people. Yeah. And so when we want to decolonize knowledge, we are saying that it's about time we allowed alternative knowledge forms to also matter in global discourses and knowledge production, right? So if you are teaching philosophy in Germany now, is it only about Plato and Keynes and so on? Where are the African philosophers? Mm-hmm. Where are women in that? We want to. And decolonizing goes beyond just adding on African philosophers or a woman philosophers, but it's a transformative process. So helping Africans themselves to change their mindset and realize that they have a lot to contribute and to document our knowledge forms and bring it on board. So we are again talking about the structures of oppression that have caused these things and that we need to question by questioning the status quo. And once we do that, then gradually, the next generation will come and inherit a world that is very open to Chinese form of knowledge, African form of knowledge, knowledge by men, knowledge by women, and so forth and so forth. In that sense, we have said that we have succeeded in decolonizing that knowledge, which, of course, is not a project. It's a process and it can take years because it took years to create and it's not as simple as having specific interventions to address these, right?
Are there any examples from your university in Ghana whereby the dominant, more colonial knowledge forms have been challenged and those other knowledge systems reclaimed?
In academic space, yes. So I contribute to the teaching of a course called Philosophical Foundations of Development. And apart from the introducing students to existing philosophical orientations and epistemic position, we have feminist epistemology and we have African philosophy as part of the course. And then we interrogate the existing form of knowledge and critique it as overlooking. And so the feminist epistemology and African philosophy are responses to these mainstream knowledge forms of philosophy, epistemology that we have it. So yes, doing it gradually through teaching, instruction, and publication is the way we have started in my university. But otherwise, there's still a long way to go.
One thing that we've talked a lot about on this show is the unequal nature often of research partnerships or collaborations between the global North and South. For you, do you have any thoughts on what would characterize a equitable or fair collaboration between, say, Europe and Africa?
Yes. For this one, I will start with the African Charter. I don't know if you know about the African Charter.
I've heard about it.
Yeah. So it has certain principles that in collaborating with the global South, it is in ways that academic internationalization effort can be equal, right? So sometimes the agenda setting is from the West. Because the West controls the world's capital resources in such international collaboration, they set the agenda. We are voting money into research into cancer. Okay, so African researchers come on board. We were not part of the agenda setting, but we help with our expertise. We collaborate, we do research, we collect data in Africa, and then sometimes in the discharge of the research also, there are inequalities. Apart from not being part of the agenda setting, there are also inequalities in the sense that once the data is collected from Africa, it is appropriated into the West and published in the West and so on and so forth. And so these are some of the inequalities that okay. Currently, you know, if I'm trying to apply for some funding, the funding source is German, and one criteria is that the lead person must be German, right? Mm-hmm. So as a Ghanaian professor, I can't access that fund without partnering with a German. And I can write the fund, partner with a German, that is fine. But to insist that the lead must be German, it's also part of the inequality, right? So, and these are some of the principles that the African Charter for Equitable Research Partnership is trying to seek. And I think that...
And this is something that, is it universities sign on to? Is that right?
It was launched 2 years ago in Windhoek in Namibia, 2023. And over 100 universities have signed on to it. And there are work going on around its publicity. And so we hope that gradually... Whether or not it to be able to change the situation, it's we wait to see. It's a matter of time, because as I have said, these problems are structural and they are historical, and so they need structural responses and specific documents like the charter or projects and interventions only provide cosmetic solutions and not address the underlying issues, which are the structures of oppression that have contributed to it.
And how can internationalization efforts like the Berlin University Alliance, are there ways in which these organizations can help and make research collaborations more equitable?
Yes, I think the Berlin and the academic internationalization efforts like the Berlin University Alliance have the potential to foster more equitable and inclusive research collaboration, because they have actively confronted existing global asymmetry in this regard. My coming from Ghana to Germany, for instance, has been useful in serving as the exchanges. In the past, the German professor will come to Ghana because he has the funds to come and rent accommodation, do research. And because we do not have much funding, we have to depend on such opportunities to come. And so making the offer available to people who otherwise would not get the funding and the opportunity to come into other spaces like this to work, I think that is useful. So it also helps in making African researchers visible and their intellectual contributions also highlighted. And then that also goes back to feeding to decolonizing knowledge, right? Yeah. This semester, during the summer semester, I taught a course titled Changing Epistemologies, African Feminist Philosophies. And we raised a number of these issues. It was a master class, right? That raised a number
Here in Berlin?
Here in Berlin, at the Free University of Berlin. And it was very useful in helping the students to understand how knowledge. So then they started questioning, okay, when we take our course readings, don't any African professors whose publications are on the course readings? Does that mean no African is researcher on ABC? So at least these are initial first steps to opening up the minds of even the future academic force, workforce. So we see how it goes. I must say that the Berlin University Alliance offers so much potential. And it's a good initiative. Having benefited from it, I'd recommend it to anybody as a very useful initiative that must be supported. Yeah.
And you'll be in Berlin until mid-October. Is there anything that, when going back to Ghana, that you're excited about researching or next steps, or is it looking more into digital platforms?
Yes, I'll be still on digitalization. I'll be an additional thing I'll be very much busy with is the digitalization of agriculture in Africa. Our agrarian economy is still very agrarian, and our agrarian folks are still very subsistence in character and not big time farmers as we have in this part of the world. Yet, we also see the infiltration of digital platforms and solutions in the agricultural space, and it's very worrying. And this infiltration is sponsored by big international capital. So, and it is very obscure who is funding this, who is behind this, and what their interests are. Mm-hmm. We find many, many, many of the big and the tech firms all infiltrated into digitalization of Africa. And we have the massive growth of local technological firms, small firms, also repackaging extension services and sending these in the form of data to farmers, and collecting a lot of data on farmers' characteristics, their farm location, the size, a lot of data. And this data, we don't have strong laws to protect. The data protection issues are also still very there. Mm-hmm. And they come, we have the introduction of seeds and farming methods that are foreign to the indigenous farmer. And so we asking questions about the farmer's sovereignty in all this and the future of the agrarian economy and how dependent they are likely to be on these sources eventually. And that's very worrying. And it's one thing that has taken my interest that I'll be looking at.
Okay, well, definitely sounds like a big and worrying thing to be spending time on. But thanks so much for joining us, Professor. That was a really interesting conversation.
Thank you very much for having me also. And very big thank you to the Berlin University Alliance for making it possible for me to be here and giving me this platform to talk to you and share my views. I'm most grateful.
That was Professor Angela Okorzu, an Audre Lorde Visiting Professor of the Berlin University Alliance and an Associate Professor of Labor and Gender Studies at the University of Cape Coast, Ghana. And that's all for this episode. Meridian is a production of the Berlin Center for Global Engagement as part of the Berlin University Alliance. Thanks for listening. I'm Kevin Kainers.